Gegen den Klimawandel unternimmt niemand etwas. Wer hat, dem wird gegeben werden. Und Frauen verdienen weniger. War ja immer schon so. Man ärgert sich und macht weiter. Was aber, wenn nicht? Wir haben eine Idee. Die Falter Arena macht die Bühne frei für Menschen und Projekte, die das Land verändern. Mein Name ist Eva Konzett. Ich leite das Politikressort im Falter. Und am Sonntag, den 26. Mai, veranstalten wir im Wiener Stadtsaal die nächste Falter Arena. Mit dabei unter anderem der ehemalige Politiker und Neosänger Matthias Strolz, Theresa Imre von Magda, Sonja Jöchtl von Love Politics oder Kari Ochsner von Ochsner Wärmepumpen. Machen statt jammern. Wir schauen uns an, wie das funktionieren kann. Kommen auch Sie vorbei. Alle Informationen und Tickets finden Sie unter falter.at/arena.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Sie haben mich mit Ihren großen Kinderaugen angeschaut und richtig begeistert mit mir gespielt. Aber mit der Zeit immer weniger, später gar nicht mehr. Einsam im kleinen Käfig und dann einfach weggegeben. Gibt's nicht jemanden, der nach vielen Jahren genauso auf mich schaut wie am ersten Tag?
Sie hörten Christine Reiler als Ratteronja. Wir geben Tieren eine Stimme. Tierschutz Austria. Mehr auf tierschutz-austria.at.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Sie hören in dieser Folge die Rede an Europa, die der israelisch-deutsche Philosoph Omri Böhm am Wiener Judenplatz gehalten hat, am 8. Mai 2024. Reden an Europa sind der Auftakt zu den Wiener Festwochen. Der amerikanische Politikwissenschaftler Timothy Snyder ist der Erste gewesen, der vor Jahren am Judenplatz das Wort ergriffen hat. Omri Böhm unterrichtet an der New School in New York, er ist Spezialist für den Philosophen Immanuel Kant und er gilt als sogenannter Universalist. Das Thema von Böhm sind die historischen Wurzeln der unterschiedlichen Reaktionen in Europa auf den israelisch-palästinensischen Konflikt. Die Rede Omri Böhms hat im Vorfeld Kontroversen ausgelöst. Die erste Stiftung stieg als Sponsor aus. Der Präsident der israelitischen Kultusgemeinde Oskar Deutsch behauptete, der israelische Philosoph öffne dem Antisemitismus das Tor. ÖVP-Ministerin Ed Stadler stoß sich an. Ariel Musikant, Chef des Europäischen Jüdischen Kongresses, meinte gar, wenn er jünger wäre, würde er faule Eier auf den Redner werfen. Der Grund? Omri Böhm tritt in seinen Schriften für einen gemeinsamen Staat von Juden und Palästinensern ein, eine binationale Konföderation im Nahen Osten. Der Judenplatz war ziemlich voll für die Rede Omri Böhms an Europa. Einige demonstrative pro-israelische Plakate waren zu sehen, aber der Redner ließ sich nicht stören. Eier wurden keine geworfen. Hören Sie im vollen Wortlaut die Rede an Europa des israelisch-deutschen Philosophen Omri Böhm, der in englischer Sprache hielt. Vorher erzählt noch Festspielpräsident Milo Rau, wie man überhaupt auf Omri Böhm als Redner gekommen ist.
Als wir uns entschieden haben für Omri Böhm, da dachte ich, erstens mal wird ein so gewaltiger Intellektueller sicherlich nicht an unsere Rede kommen. Er ist gekommen. Und gleichzeitig dachte ich, Omri Böhm ist ein Akademiker, ein Philosoph, ein Kantianer. Er ist vielleicht zu vermittelnd, vielleicht zu wenig provokant, um wirklich eine Debatte auszulösen. Und jetzt hat er die wohl größte Debatte ausgelöst, die es hier je gab. Es wurden alle möglichen Meinungen geäußert von jedem, in jeglicher Hinsicht. Es wurden Eierwürfe angedroht. Und ich habe mir gedacht, es ist interessant, dass in einer unversöhnlichen Zeit wie unserer gerade ein Versöhner wie Omri Böhm ein Provokateur sein soll. Das hat mich sehr gewundert und ich will deshalb eigentlich nur noch eine Bitte aussprechen. Meine Damen und Herren, lassen Sie die Eier bitte da, wo sie hingehören. Omri, bitte.
Ja, thanks very much. I've heard that there was a controversy about this talk. And I have a little warning. I intend to try to disappoint everybody. There is a big sign in my back that I saw the moment I entered this place when it was still empty. No one was, almost no one was here. There is a big sign hanging. I'm not sure if the sort of demonstration or protest against my speaking here. It reads, "Dämonisierung Israels ist Antisemitismus." I want to endorse this statement. This is exactly what it is. No one has any intention, not in this stage in any case, to demonize Israel. And when this happens, this has to be immediately called out. With no compromises. But our ability to do this effectively also depends on criticizing the attempts to call demonizations, instances when legitimate criticism, with which we may or may not agree, is being articulated, especially in those very difficult days. That's, among other things, what I'm going to speak about today. When I was first invited to give this Rede an Europa on Judenplatz, there was one personal reason, very personal reason, why I was so especially delighted to accept the invitation, and that's my own family's history. My son and wife had just received their Austrian citizenship, and they received it because of my wife's family had in fact escaped Austria, in any case, those who did escape, including my wife's grandmother, Malita Miriam Scherzer, who was driven out of the city, Vienna, to Palestine in 1938 on the same youth aliyah, as far as I know, with which my own grandmother had escaped Germany. For us, this Rede an Europa was planned also as a private visit to Miriam's city and to her school, the Brigittenauer Gymnasium, now the Gymnasium am Augarten, a school that has a familiar Gedenkstätte commemorating Miriam's Jewish classmates who did not escape and were eventually deported to Auschwitz. Miriam's parents were sent from Vienna to Dachau and Auschwitz and survived it, eventually reuniting with their daughter in Israel. I still remember Miriam trying to impress her with my German and with some stories about Europe, the Europe to which she never returned after 38. How shy, how surprised and happy was that senior lady from a small moshav in Israel who had started her life as Malita in Vienna. Much before rumors of a debate about this talk started, I knew that we were coming here not with an understanding, but with a very personal knowledge by acquaintance of the significance of this place, and with a very immediate feeling that personal, unbearable memories have here immense public significance. We know as well as anybody the deep roots that this location has, Judenplatz, to this city, to this continent. And we also know, again, as well as anybody can, the branches that this place's roots then in turn send far away to our country, Israel. That is also the reason why I refuse to dishonor this place. Not by anything that I will say or could have said, even less so by playing into attempts to turn discussion, to turn a discussion that should be about content, about argument, respectful disagreement, in good faith, to turn that into an artificial scandal. It is for me also personally, and not just personally, especially meaningful to have Lessing look at the memorial behind me here on Judenplatz, and looking at all of us. Because it is Lessing who basically showed us the strong relation, the essential relation between enlightenment and friendship.
You lie! You are lying!
Live it, live it. Live it. The answer is the following. The liberal democratic friends of Judenplatz, friends like in the tradition of Lessing, the friends of Europe, discuss their disagreements, the calms, the worries that they may have. Friends, the guys who are protesting, I hope you hear me as well. I hear you. I hear you, but I hope you hear me too. The friends.
We hear you, but we are not agree with you.
That's excellent. That is exactly the attitude we should be about. The friends of Europe discuss their disagreements, the worries that they may have, and they remember that reason goes hand in hand with friendship, populism and nationalism, with shouting and attempts to humiliate each other. Choosing the former, that is reason and friendship, over the latter, is putting the noise aside, stretching the hand also to those who were criticizing this talk so fiercely and who are standing here and protesting and suggesting to move on and think together. You are more than your myth. You are more than your myth. When in 2019, Timothy Snyder, who was mentioned here, inaugurated the Rede an Europa on Judenplatz, he coined this message as a motto of the talk. You are more than your myth. I want to join that message, but ask again, what does it mean for Europe to be more than its myth? One way to think about this motto is to say that Europe must confront myth with history. That was Snyder's suggestion. He claimed that if Europe was to fulfill its role as a symbol of hope, and it is a symbol of hope, then Europeans must choose history as the opposite of myth. There are two ways to remember, Snyder argued. One is through the myth that lead you back to the story how you were always right. And that's why myths are always national, if not nationalistic. Another way to remember is history, which allows you to take what you remember, add to it critical perspective, and recognize your responsibility to the past, as Europe with its past of a crumbling empire. I want to agree with Snyder that Europe must be more than its myth. Agree also that history is important, even necessary, but add that I think it is not enough. To be more than its myth, Europe will have to insist on the reality of its ideals. For in fact, history is not the opposite of myth. Reason is. It is if it can take the authority of its own ideals seriously. And the authority of history, also the type that makes us recognize our responsibility over the past, can sometimes serve to undermine our ideals. Here's another way to put it. History ought to be respected, and it ought to be respected because of our commitment to ideals. If the ideals themselves are respected because of our commitment to history, then this commitment can also threaten to render our ideals into myth, indeed into national myth. This challenge now confronts Europe. It confronts European politics, and it confronts European intellectual life as the populist right is on the rise, threatening to abuse historical responsibility. This challenge now... Don't ever forget that when we speak about the abuse of historical responsibility, it always needs to be in the name of defending historical responsibility. This challenge now ought to be dealt with, not by denying the authority of history, just the contrary, by protecting it by insisting on the reality of ideal, and that's what I'd like to talk about. And I will begin in the start. When the United States severed its ties from Europe and asserted its independence from a European sovereignty, it did that by invoking the authority of truth, not of history. We hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Can we still stand by the authority of this self-evident truth asserted by the American Declaration of Independence today? It seems to me that most people, from the so-called post-colonial critics of enlightenment to centrist liberal theorists, in fact tend to reject this very proposition. On the one hand of the spectrum, people complain that the founding fathers, the American founding fathers, who articulated this truth, were themselves slaveholders. That men, in the statement, all men are created equal, means literally men and exclusively white. That is, that Enlightenment universalism is at best, a mask of enlightenment that allows European men to discriminate while congratulating themselves of holding fast to beautiful universalist ideals. At worst, the claim is, these ideals are in fact the ideology that makes Europeans discriminate, exterminate, and enslave. The argument, slightly more specifically, is the following. The cosmopolitan tradition, which makes man or humanity the measure of all things, the origin of value, is indistinguishable from the tradition that makes man the master and possessor of nature. And if this is so, then the cosmopolitan tradition that begins with the theory of the dignity of humanity ends up in practice as a history that made Europeans into the colonizers of continents, the abusers of nature, now causing nature's death, and of owning other humans as slaves. The Declaration of Independence asserts then not self-evident truth, but myth, since it is a myth that tells us that we were always right, even when obviously we were not. On the other side of the spectrum, among liberal thinkers in the political center, people often pretend to shake their heads when they see the denial of European Enlightenment universalism. But in fact, post-war liberal thinking consists in a very similar denial. When the father of American liberal thinking, that's John Rawls, says that justice, this is now a familiar slogan, is political, not metaphysical, he means just that. Self-evident truth, like the ones asserted in the Declaration of Independence, can have no authority in modern democratic societies. Here is a quote: "Truth about an independent metaphysical order cannot provide the basis for a political conception of justice in democratic societies." This is, in fact, sounds a little bit academic, it is in fact a dramatic rejection of the Declaration of Independence. Its self-evident truth, if Rawls here is correct, need to be treated like religion, tolerated, respected as people's private faith, exactly not recognized as a self-evident truth that bases the authority of law. The point, my point now then is this: not just the so-called post-colonial or identitarian left rejects the universal ideal of the European Enlightenment. In fact, there is a broad consensus about this rejection among the left and the liberal center. That it is rejected by the growing identitarian populist right in Europe does not require much of an argument. Now, I deliberately went to questions important from 1776 America because it is easier to first pretend that they are far away before bringing them back to the heart of current European reality. It is a remarkable fact, that whereas the Americans never gave the self-evident truth asserted in the Declaration of Independence a legal significance, that is, they never integrated them into the Constitution, post-war Europe did take that step, and it took it with a statement: Die Würde des Menschen ist unantastbar. Human dignity is inviolable. This is, of course, a well-known first sentence of German Grundgesetz, but it is very important here that it is much more than just that. The exact same sentence is also the first article of the European Union's Charter of Fundamental Rights. And the ideal of human dignity is also the anchor of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which gave the model to numerous post-war European constitution, so not the Austrian, not for Kelsen, and if you ask me, it's never too late. The assertion that human dignity is unantastbar, is the origin of law, posits an ideal of Enlightenment universalism that's, for our purposes, identical with the self-evident truth of the Declaration of Independence. It affirms that human dignity is inalienable, as well as that the authority of law has to be relative to it. And by the way, this renders the universalist or cosmopolitan tradition that's expressed by it much nearer to a radical, even abolitionist democracy than is commonly recognized, and this is something that I'm going to put here aside and ask two questions. First, Is this principle, expressing the ideal of enlightenment universalism, die Würde des Menschen ist unantastbar, is it in fact an expression of Europe's racism and colonialism? Should we reenact the ideal of human dignity as the answer to Europe's past monumental crimes as an empire, from the crimes of the Holocaust to those of colonialism? Or is such humanism, in fact, the cause of these crimes? And German Grundgesetz, like the European Charter of Fundamental Rights and the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, must be decolonized. Second, if we stand by this principle, as I think we should, can European liberal thinkers genuinely stand by it? And by genuinely, not usually a technical philosophical term, by genuinely I mean to ask, stand by it also when that principle may challenge their interests, their identity, their innermost commitments? Or does our hope to ground the commitment to human dignity in historical responsibilities also marks the limits of this ideal, thereby threatening to turn it into myth? And I want to deal with these questions slowly. Take first another look at that sentence, Die Würde des Menschen ist unantastbar. On a first glance, it doesn't look like a myth, but as a straightforward falsity. Human dignity is violable, and among other things, as the friends here who are protesting show us with the photos of Israeli hostages, it is violated as we speak.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If it is not just a false proposition, then what could make it seem like one is actually what makes it so poetic or even prophetic. One of the great innovations of the biblical Hebrew prophets was a stylistic one, and I know it sounds that I'm drifting, but I'm not. The biblical prophets used to state the counterfactual, even the impossible, as actually true. Arguably, this stylistic innovation had everything to do with their humanistic discovery, the proposition that plainly asserts descriptively something that seems at best prescriptive, human dignity is inviolable, asserting the imperative, not as an imperative, but as truth, is strictly speaking either false or somehow reaching out to describe a higher reality. When you understand that, you understand something very deep that is driving in the Hebrew prophets, in Plato, and in Kant. Giving this laconic sentence, Die Würde des Menschen ist unantastbar, the aesthetics of the sublime. The being that is in turn capable of making such a statement and experience the feeling that this poetic gesture creates has dignity, Würde, and commands respect. You might think that what we sometimes call reality, the one in which we go to buy milk in the supermarket, the one in which whole Jewish families are massacred and burned on the border of Gaza, the one in which whole Palestinian population is being starved and bombed, So this reality renders this ideal into a myth, and the poetics that I was talking about into populist kitsch. The decision, which one it will be, has to depend on us. Now, we might ask ourselves, if the ideal of human dignity is valid, what makes it so? What makes it valid? I don't want to address that question here. More crucial for us is what could not, what does not make it valid. If the idea that human dignity is unantastable is supposed to be grounded in the decision of a people, say the European, the Germans, the Italians, the Austrians, their decision to live by this ideal, then that very fact, in fact, provides the explanation of why human dignity is actually violable. An unconditional claim cannot depend on anybody's decision. It's very nice that, say, the German people have decided to treat human dignity as inviolable. We know very well that they can also decide otherwise. This realization makes an important point that I think we need to notice. Subscribing to human dignity is unantastable cannot depend on national sovereignty. It cannot depend on the decision of a people. Human dignity marks the limit of national sovereignty. Now, this fact is important because it shows the continuity between this abstract, nice talk about human dignity and two very concrete European trends. First, the tendency to limit national sovereignty, to restrict through states' own prerogatives their own sovereignty. For example, by entering a federative constellation, by submitting to international law or international and European courts. Europe has certainly moved in line with the recognition of human dignity from national to international to cosmopolitan law. That is, from a form of law that depends on states' ultimate national sovereignty to one that respects it, to one that respects it but questions it. The second trend is what I call constitutional patriotism, and by that I mean here the very broad idea, the recognition that belonging to a sovereign nation requires neither the right blood, nor the right language, history, or culture. You belong to the German, Austrian, or Italian people in virtue of having German, Italian, Austrian citizenship. When in 2019 Timothy Snyder stood here and called on Europe to be more than its myth, he warned Europeans, and I'm quoting from Snyder, "Your little implausible national myth allow you not to see what is so unique about Europe. Namely, and I'm quoting, that the European Union is the one successful answer to the most important question in the history of the modern world." I'll read that sentence again because it's very dramatic. "The European Union is the one successful answer to the most important question in the history of the modern world." And the question is, I'm quoting from Snyder, "What to do after empire? What to do with empire?" There are, Snyder says, two bad answers. Make nation states or have more empire. The European Union is the only new fruitful, productive answer to that question, rather than those two bad ones. I'm repeating this quote here because the move to respect human dignity, an abstract notion, by the concrete checking of national sovereignty and replacing the nation with a strong concept of citizenship are the essential innovating ingredients of Europe's answer to that monumental question. This answer replaced the Hobbes-Schmittian attachment to a sovereign Leviathan as the answer to the war of all against all, and asserted that dignity must be the foundation of human polity, not fear, dignity instead of fear, and that to protect dignity through the rule of law, sovereignty has to be questioned, criticized, even deconstructed, not asserted through national leviathans. When Thomas Hobbes spoke of Leviathan, that mythical monster, he knew why. It was because sovereignty required myth and depended on myth. And here is now my main point. Whereas here lies the essential expression of Europe's successful answer to its past, to the most important question of the modern world, namely the replacement of national leviathans, European thinkers actually embraced the exact opposite of these principles, insofar as Europe has been looking outside to the victims of empire. If the crumbling European empire eventually learned to question sovereignty, the idea was also that insofar as colonized nations are concerned, sovereignty is the ultimate vehicle of their liberation. And same for the Holocaust. Insofar as the Holocaust was concerned, the idea was that Jews must defend themselves and restore their dignity as a nation after the systematic extermination of European Jewry through a sovereign Jewish state. Und passt auf, in those moments in history, they were anything but wrong. Therefore, when applied to Europe's victims, Europe's answer can seem and has seemed like the lingering intellectual baggage of empire, or like the remains of colonialist ideology that asked to go on imposing itself on Europe's victims and prevent their liberation, also after empire has ended. Does Europe's successful answer to the past of empire apply also to this empire's past victims? That is, I think, the essential question, and it is haunting Europe. And here is another question. Can Europe's answer survive if we contradict its answer insofar as its victims are concerned? Quite simply, if we recognize that others, the victims of empire, may have the right to violate human dignity, we recognize thereby our duty to respect the right to do so, and human dignity is then, at most, very important for us, but not unantastbar. That's a crucial point. Once you recognize that externally, you also recognize something internally. You simply cannot claim human dignity as unantastbar also within the continent. To play a variation then on Snyder's point, here seems to lie the most important question about the answer given to the most important question in modern history. For post-colonial thinkers, Limiting liberated nations through the cosmopolitan idea of humanity could seem like a form of neocolonialism, imposing the answers of Europe on its victims, preventing emancipation. When it comes not to colonialism but to the Holocaust, the opposition is exactly the same. Try to suggest that an Israeli constitution would start not with the sovereignty of the Jewish people, but with a commitment to dignity as the origin of law.
It's reading over there, by the way.
This amounts to imposing European cosmopolitan ideals to the questions of Jewish sovereignty. To one side, then, such universalist politics seem like racism or colonialism. To the other, like anti-Semitism. And since all sides here view sovereignty as a zero-sum condition of their very existence, these doctrines are now not just in conflict, but on a collision course. The situation is so violent and the debate so heated, not because the sides are so different from one another, but because they are so similar. For many on the left, certainly the so-called postcolonial, and I do not want to put all theories in one box, the Palestinians are the ultimate embodiment of the struggle against European colonialism. Whoever questions the right to armed resistance, for example, by condemning Hamas attack on civilians, relativizes or contextualizes colonialism. What right is there for Europeans, the argument goes, an awful argument, to criticize the use of power of those who in the first place are not protected by law and are not citizens of their own sovereign state? On the other hand, in Germany, say, in Austria, I suspect, and not just there and here, we see the same and opposite idea that Jews, represented by the State of Israel, embody human suffering and the right of self-defense. Whoever demands that the country would subscribe to a neutral, liberal, democratic constitution, asserting a state of all its citizens, and be completely accountable to international law, in fact, relativizes the Jews' right to self-defense. Whereas Europe's answer to its crumbling empire was to deconstruct sovereignty by asserting human dignity as its limit. Its victims' answer was to assert national sovereignty as unantastbar. So not human dignity, but national sovereignty has become unantastbar. Each side thus pretends to embody something ultimate, absolute, that relativizes, in fact, the dignity of those belonging to the other group. That's the logic that we have to break, to overcome. And since people are applauding to this, to overcome it, it is necessary, don't forget, it is necessary to remember why it came about. This was clear, among other things, in the responses you saw in intellectual circles to Hamas' systematic, sadistic massacre of whole families, rape, and burning. There ought to be, no pretending about this, even though sometimes there is. The tendency on campuses was moving on a spectrum of being exhilarated by this act, tolerating it, or at least insisting that the Palestinians have a right of armed resistance vis-a-vis their quote-unquote colonizers. If you argued that was at best tolerating genocidal anti-Semitism and at worst supporting it, the widespread insistence was that Hamas is not an anti-Semitic organization, among other things because the attack targeted only Israelis, not Jews as such. But in fact, Hamas charter of 1988 states clearly, and this is a quote, "The day of judgment will not come about until Muslims kill the Jews. And when the Jew will hide behind stones and trees, the stones and the trees will say, 'Oh Muslims, there is a Jew behind me. Come and kill them.'" There used to be a tendency to ignore this clause or to claim that Hamas has given up on it. Let's not pretend. It is pretty clear that this exact line about the Day of Judgment was alive in the minds of those who conducted the massacre. Quite a few of them seem to have thought that on October 7, the Day of Judgment has arrived. Tolerating this is widespread, and it is important to say that this toleration proceeds exactly with the idea of the sovereignty of the colonized in mind. This becomes clearest when often the same people now chant, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Make no mistake, and I say this as a supporter of a democracy for all between the river and the sea. Make no mistake, when these people chant that, they do not mean democratic for all, but free from Jews. Or to be most accurate, and this is now just the point, they tend to suspend judgment in order to reject the allegedly neo-colonialist assumption that they have the right to decide for Palestinians. On that view, whether from the river to the sea Palestine should be free means free from Jews or democratic for all is not something for former European colonizers to decide for Palestinians. National sovereignty is treated as the unantastable vehicle of liberation. As Varoufakis put it when he was asked about it, and I'm quoting, "I was asked whether I condemned Hamas, and I said no, but I condemned every violence against civilians. I also don't condemn the Israeli settlers, also not Benjamin Netanyahu. I condemn us Europeans." If you ask me, with all due respect to Varoufakis, this is not to take historical responsibility as Europeans seriously, but to make a mockery of it. The other side of the spectrum operates by the exact same logic. It is most visible in the false tendency among a certain European liberal center to treat the Holocaust as a universal signifier. As one author whom I respect put it, "Holocaust commemoration has become universal or cosmopolitan memory." In this view, the event, the Holocaust, is becoming a symbol not of a specific past whole, but of any systematic violation of human rights. And by the same token, it is also no longer the exclusive property of the national groups directly involved in this historical event, Jews on the one side, Germans and Europeans on the other. Rather, Holocaust commemoration plays, according to this view, a crucial role reinforcing international law and human rights, thus becoming, and this is a quote, becoming a potential symbol of global solidarity. Wait. On a first look, this could seem like a friendly thesis about memory or history, as it calls for universalist commitments. On a second, it should become, I think, clear that this is exactly the type of thesis that has given universalism its bad name. And indeed, the type of thesis that threatens to present universalism all allegedly universal memory as a colonial project. In the way in which the Holocaust is being commemorated, it is commemorated in the service of rather particular national projects. Therefore, this allegedly universal symbol excludes from what was called here global solidarity those for whom this symbol is anything but open. Specifically, since Holocaust commemoration has been interpreted as the argument for Jews' national sovereignty, and again, for understandable reasons, it does not promote international human rights, especially not of those whose human rights and national rights could seem to stand in the way. One of the most significant examples of this trend is the relation of the German government to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The institution of international law and international tribunals authorized to prosecute war crimes was developed in close relation to Nazi crimes, and this is an excellent reason for Germany, taking historical responsibility, to be one of the international court's main sponsors, the ICC. The German Foreign Office has gone out of its way in the past to defend the ICC against, say, meddling attempts by the Trump administration, stating that, and this is a quote, any attempt to undermine the independence of the court would not be tolerated. That is a statement against the United States at the time. But when the prosecutor in The Hague started an initial investigation, this is 4 years ago, an initial investigation of Israel for war crimes allegedly committed in the occupied territories, Germany contended that the court had no jurisdiction. Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute, which regulates the court's mandate, and Palestine is not recognized as a state. That was the argument. Once the ICC's justices contradicted that opinion, and with good reason, they issued a decision according to which Palestine had been recognized as a state party to the Rome Statute, regardless of the question whether it is a state or not. So the court does have jurisdiction in the Palestinian territories. A spokesman for the German Foreign Office stated, and this is a quote, our position on this case is unchanged. According to our legal position, the International Criminal Court and its office of the prosecutor do not have jurisdiction. The German Foreign Ministry stated the same. This is, of course, only an example, but I want to explain why it is so crucial. To understand how grave these statements are, it is necessary to put the question of the court's jurisdiction in Palestine aside. This is about the court's authority. And recognizing it means exactly to take its decision as sufficient to change Germany's legal position, limiting its sovereignty. The claim of the German government that the court has no jurisdiction in Palestinian territories, despite the justice's decision that it does, did not just deny the jurisdiction of the court over the Palestinian authorities. It questioned the autonomy and authority of the court. This is a good example of the trend that I was talking about, a good example of what it looks like when the commitment to Europe's answer to its past, if it is grounded through history, meets its limits and become not just un-universal, not just not universal, but anti-universal. This is not just an issue of foreign policy. Germany here asserted its own sovereignty to oppose the autonomy of the court in order to protect Jewish sovereignty from the court's authority. And since Germany is the chief sponsor of the court, this constitutes a serious threat to this institution. This was 4 years ago. The effects of this questioning of the court and the teeth of international law we see now. Does the ICC have authority in the territory as Gaza is being starved and as Israeli cabinet ministers speak about entering Rafah since, and this is a quote, we will not do half a job but need full annihilation. Too bad that Varoufakis also apparently cannot criticize that statement. This then is a question. Is Europe to think of the answer that it has given to the most important question of the 20th century as its own answer only, as one that may be good here, but in fact isn't just wrong, but illegitimate elsewhere? Or is in fact limiting it in this way already betraying the answer that Europe has given to itself, writing the first sentence in the history of this answer's decay also within Europe, thereby handing over the argument to Europe's enemies? Consider the opposition to this talk here on Judenplatz. Is the idea illegitimate that to save Israel and Palestine from falling into a yet worse dystopia requires us to imagine a transition of the region in the direction of a European constellation following the same patterns of that great European answer, with sub-sovereign nations joining a confederative common constitution for the whole region? Is that illegitimate rather than right or wrong? Is this federative idea, which is now necessary, I submit, to take seriously Immanuel Kant's warning that peace talks and peace agreements ought not become lies that lead to zero-sum wars that undermine the very possibility of peace? Is that illegitimate? If the European answer here is delegitimized in this way, how does this reflect on Europe? How does allowing a dehumanization and total war logic in Israel and Palestine affect Europe's own Jewish and own Muslim Palestinian citizens? Does this not hand over the argument to the populist nationalist right that is on the rise all around us, wishing to assert national sovereignty, question international law, and reassert citizenship that's based on ethnic belonging? And this then would be my call to Europe. Insist on the reality of your ideals. They are important all the more because of historical responsibility, but ultimately, as cosmopolitan ideals, they cannot be understood as depending on or limited by historical responsibility. In the dark, difficult juncture in which politics and thinking now find themselves, we must reject the tendency on all sides to undermine Europe's ideals by a very irresponsible way of speaking on historical responsibility. That is the only way to keep also Europe's historical commitments, and to prevent these commitments from becoming themselves national forms of mythical thinking. Thank you very much.
Das war die Rede an Europa des Philosophen Omri Böhm vom Wiener Judenplatz am 8. Mai 2024. Ich bedanke mich bei den Veranstaltern, den Wiener Festwochen und dem Institut für die Wissenschaften vom Menschen für die Zusammenarbeit, bei Sarah Preyer und Robert Bastetzky für die Tonaufnahme bei der Veranstaltung. Über Debatten rund um die Festwochen lesen Sie regelmäßig im Falter. Ein Abonnement des Falter hält Sie am Laufenden. Alle Informationen gibt es im Internet unter der Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet, Miriam Hübel betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Folge.
Sie hörten das Falterradio, den Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.